Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters. Hello. By the reign of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Empire seemed to be unchallenged in the reach of its power, its wealth, and its cultural and intellectual sophistication. The Pax Romana stretched from Britain and Portugal to Syria and Egypt and covered over millions of people. Yet at the moment of its seemingly greatest achievement, Rome was struck by a disease that annihilated its legions and ravaged its cities. This was the Antonine Plague, perhaps history's first pandemic, and its origins and its diagnosis remain mysterious. But my guest Colin Elliott argues that it was both the cause and the effect of the empire's decline, a disease which both exposed the crumbling foundations of the empire and then accelerated that crumbling. Colin Elliott is Associate Professor of History at Indiana University. His most recent book is Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World, and it is the subject of our conversation today. Colin, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with you.
Well, there's nothing I enjoy more than a good juicy pandemic to sink your teeth into. And as we were saying, as we were chatting before we started recording, I was into plagues and epidemics before it was cool.
Yeah.
And I know you were too.
I was.
Because if you fumble around medieval and ancient history, you're going to come to the conclusion that pandemics are awfully, awfully important.
Yep.
But before we get to the cool pandemic stuff, the box office stuff for which the punters are entering the theater. Why don't you give your sort of Edward Gibbon-esque description of Rome in the time of Marcus Aurelius? I've done it before with a Gibbon accent when I was talking with Tom Holland. I won't make you submit to that. But what's the sort of the standard received view that people have of the Pax Romana, sort of like at the middle point of Marcus Aurelius's reign?
Yeah, I like that you asked about the received view, because there's the received view, and then I think what was really going on. The received
view. We're going to get to that, but that's, yeah. I always liked on the podcast talk about the SRV, the standard received
view. That's right.
View.
The SRV for the Pax Romana around the time that Marcus takes over is that it is a prosperous empire, highly connected. Rome is at its most victorious, its most glorious, at its largest territorial extent. It is serving a population of something like 50 to 60 million people at minimum. Many of those live in cities, perhaps about 20% of the population live in cities, which would make the Roman Empire, as having one of the highest urbanization rates in any pre-industrial empire ever in history. It is a period in which there are two emperors that have just taken over for the first time, Marcus, a stoic and studious philosopher king, and his co-emperor and adopted brother Lucius Verus, who is a younger man, but an adventurer and a leader of men, that sort of person. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like the peace and prosperity that had existed for the previous, say, 150 years or so was just going to keep on ticking. Everything was looking good. Marcus's wife was pregnant with what would become twin boys. So there were potential heirs available. I mean, everything just looked great when Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus took over.
But you argue that the peace was fragile.
Yep.
And that there was plenty of dry tinder, which, you know, like any fire, like disease, like fire, it starts with dry tinder and it consumes it. It lives on the conditions of its birth.
That's
until
right.
Until it's destroyed that which gives it life.
That's right.
So what is the dry tinder?
Yeah. So, or to use another analogy, you could almost view it as like the empire was running on fumes in a sense. Like this veneer of peace and prosperity comes to us because the people that write about it are elites. So they are benefiting from an empire that actually the foundations are not very strong. The empire is pervasively run by slave labor. It's an agricultural economy, and it's dependent on these breadbaskets. So the whole food supply for all of these cities and these people that are living in cities, including Rome, which is supporting something like a million people. The entire food supply is largely based on three bread baskets. So we talk about like diversifying our stocks so we're not susceptible to market crashes. The Romans did not really diversify their food supply. They're resting on Egypt, on North Africa, and Sicily. And if there was ever any kind of disruptions in the climate in any of those bread baskets, that could threaten up to a third or more of the food supply. The Roman military certainly had been victorious over the last 150 years, but it was also in kind of a state of lethargy and had not had some serious wars to challenge it. So there was that too. So food supply issues, the military was there. And Rome was heavily dependent upon its kind of climatological context. So there had been some great years, some warm years, some wet years in the Mediterranean and in other parts of the Eurasian landmass. And those were about to come to an end. So this was much more fragile than maybe the Romans even understood.
So people are always unaware. I think there's an idea that ancient cities, probably they had gardens. And they could eat what they this is a million people in this city.
Yeah.
If everyone had a small garden on their rooftop, there wouldn't be enough food.
Yeah.
There would not be enough carbohydrates. Yeah. So there's already they're dependent on grain shipments, and they have been since hundreds of years BC. I mean, like Athens and other Mediterranean cities have been getting shipments from the Crimea. I'm going to look back. I'll link to an episode with Scott Nelson about Crimean grain and Ukrainian grain. That's been feeding Mediterranean cities for centuries, almost 1,000 years prior to Marcus Aurelius. I think, is that about right? Yeah, it's probably about right. Mm. So this has been going on for a while, but it's very different than if there's like a Ukraine war, then other Argentina or Brazil or South Dakota can pick up the slack because it's a world economy. This is a Mediterranean economy. Mm-hmm. It's an economy in a single climactic region is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
So if something goes wrong with the climate in the Mediterranean, something goes wrong with the food in Rome and also in other big cities like Marseille.
Like Ephesus and Antioch and Alexandria.
Alexandria, of course.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, and these are also huge cities, and they're dependent on grain shipments. They cannot feed themselves with what lies in their immediate hinterland.
Right. And the grain is coming. It's being produced for the time, relatively advanced agricultural techniques, but still techniques that do not lift the agricultural economy above kind of the vagaries of the climate. I mean, there are not super crops. There's not genetically modified organisms. They can dig canals and things like that to help. But yeah, there's a strong dependence still on the pre-industrial context, and the state is heavily involved. So you mentioned like in the current system, if one region fails, there are numerous others that can take the slack, and there are market forces which can cause prices to change, which will incentivize production. People will shift the way that they're doing things so that they can make the thing where they're going to get more profit, which causes them to produce the resources that's the way kind of a global capitalism kind of works. It's one of the benefits. They don't have anything like that in the Roman world. So
no price signals.
Yeah, exactly. There really aren't. I mean, there are prices on the margins that are kind of supply and demand prices, but largely the grain is extracted by the Roman state. It's taxed by the Roman state. It's shipped by the dictates of the Roman state in ships that are insured by the Roman state. The dock workers that unload the ships are kind of given a state monopoly on doing that. In some cases, even the ships have to like leave and arrive in a certain order. And so their speed is sort of metered and there's a threshold on the speed that they can go. All that's done by the state is distributed by the state.
This is an innovation, right? I mean, because this is the bread part of bread and circuses.
Yeah.
This is the emperors realizing if you want to stay in power, keep the Romans, the people, the citizens of the city happy. So give them grain at cost, essentially.
Right. It's not an economic plan. It's like a social and political plan. Like this goes right back to before there were even emperors in Rome, when there were ambitious politicians in the late Republic, like the Gracchi brothers, for example, and others that wanted to score political points, wanted to make sure that the mob did not go after them, that the mob was on their side. And what better way to make a mob happy than to ensure that their bellies are full? And so it kind of goes back to this. And obviously there is also kind of an ancient morality that says the elites should feed the general population. Like they have a burden, they have an obligation. If they own so much land, it is their job in some ways to provide. And so it's not the same as like a command economy. It's not those type. There's not an ideology involved in it. It's not about economics at all. It's really about doing the duty of feeding the population. And as you rightly say, keeping the population pacified so that they do not revolt. And so much of Rome's energy goes into this food extraction and distribution system.
Yeah. It never understood really for a long time why the secret police or the secret agents were the frumentarii.
That's right.
What's the literal translation of that?
Yeah. Like the grain men or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be something like that.
It shows you the role of grain and grain shipments for the tranquility of the regime, that the grain men become sort of secret police / secret agent types.
Right, because the grain shipment is the great, you know, these provinces, by the way, which are producing grain, like especially Egypt, I mean, these are valuable places. You do not want a rebellion in Egypt. So you need to keep a close eye on the governor of Egypt. And so naturally, it makes sense that your grain supervisors, your grain officers would end up becoming spies. And and we can get to it later, but when Marcus Aurelius deals with a kind of insurrection or a kind of rebellion, it's in Egypt. And, you know, is maybe one of his frumentarii told him about what was going on. Who knows?
Other dry tinder. You've already said the percentage of Rome that's in urbanized. What percentage of the population is living in cities, as best as we can tell?
Yeah, so it's probably around 15 million, 20 million people, could have been more. And to emphasize what this means, it's not just about the numbers, which is obviously huge. That number is a huge number living in cities you would not have numbers like that living in cities in this part of the world until close to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, it is really a huge deal. But they're living densely. They're living packed in the cities, on top of each other. And Rome nor any other ancient city has skyscrapers. Instead, the way that they pack people in is in kind of transient spaces. They smush them into apartment buildings. They live in caves. They live in bushes. They live in alleys. A huge number of the ancient urban population in the Roman Empire were transient people in some ways, or just had kind of semi-permanent housing. So they're smushed together. It's unsanitary. It's a pretty nasty. It's not like nice cities.
It's so fascinating. It's one of the, as Tom Holland emphasizes, they're not like us. And one of the ways is that they're not even like people 1,000 years later. In the 16th century, one of the great, you know, besetting sins of England for the moralists, which kind of leads to the creation of colonial America, is the transient population, mm-hmm. The unhoused, that we have to find ways of housing them, but we also need to find a safety valve to release them to places where they can have land. And that's, mm-hmm. That's the need for expanding. That's not the Romans are. They're not worried about that. That's not a thing that in our sources, at least, there's no evidence for worrying about the unhoused in ancient Roman cities.
Not as a moral concern. Certainly not. No. I mean, they do have this impulse from time to time of like and this is in the Republic, of sort of providing land for these people. But it's really so that they can serve in the military, because for a brief period, well, for a long period of time, Rome's army were citizen soldiers. So if you wanted more military men, you needed to have more landed men. And so they would occasionally send a few landless people out, give them some land out in the country. But there was never a moral concern. And certainly by the time of the emperors, this is not happening at all. There are no more massive land grants to kind of transient landless citizens. This doesn't exist. Essentially, they're given cash handouts. They're given gladiatorial games. They're given bread. They're given other forms of beneficence. but an actual serious solution to the problem is never conceived of, because really it's not a moral problem.
And is this, are these the people that under the empire become the soldiers? Is the army a way of, you know, eventually getting your land grant in Morocco or Lusitania or someplace,
yep,
or God help us, Syria? You know, it's, well, this is dry. Lusitania isn't.
Yeah, you're thinking like a Roman emperor. So this, you're exactly right. These people would serve, once the requirement to own land, once that requirement is broken in the late Republic, and anybody can be a soldier as long as they have citizenship. And indeed, many who are not citizens can be soldiers. They're often conscripted into the army. But either way, the army represents a path out. At the end of service, there would be a large retirement bonus that was paid. And originally, it was paid in land. But over time, it would not be land. It would just be a large cash payment after 20, 25 years or so of service. Often citizenship would be included if the soldier was not a citizen, so they could become a Roman citizen that way. And yeah, potentially use that money to buy a little farm somewhere out in the nether reaches of the empire, often usually where they were garrisoned, because soldiers would accumulate unofficial families while they were out serving. They were not allowed to marry up until the third century AD, but they could kind of accumulate common law wives and even have illegitimate children. And then later they could go back there with their retirement bonus and officially sort of settle down. Yeah.
So that's this transient population. That's the first sort of stick of kindling for the tinder.
Yep.
It's also, you go into quite some details about how filthy a Roman city is. I don't know about you, but one of the books that was important to me as a kid was David Macaulay's City.
Okay.
Where we've got sewers, we've got aqueducts, we've got, you know, stepping stones. It's, you know, Roman cities, I figured that was a lot better than Philadelphia in the late 70s. But you lay out that even Philadelphia in the 70s was at least a several degrees of magnitude better than Rome or Alexandria or Antioch.
That's right.
And I was unfortunately drinking a cup of coffee when I was reading your description of the Roman bath, and that kind of put me off of warm drinks for at least a week, I think. I had a hell of a caffeine headache. So could you describe the Roman bath as a epitome of how we have sort of really prissied up,
yeah,
the Roman world?
Yeah. So you imagine, I mean, we use a bath.
I'm just going to warn listeners, by the way, if you're drinking something, put it down.
Yeah. So the first chapter of the book, especially, is not for the weak stomached. The bath is a great example of this. We would use a bath to clean ourselves, is what we associate baths with. And so we see Roman baths, we hear about Roman baths, we think, oh, they must have been a very clean people. But first, okay, this is not bath water that is cycling. Okay, so the bath water is stagnant. I mean, it would overflow, so it would gradually maybe move, but it's not chlorinated. I mean, so really what we're talking about are ponds. So people are bathing in ponds. It was important if you were unwell to go to the bath in the morning. If you had a wound that was gangrenous, you need to go to the bath to clean it off. Many people they don't have baths in their houses, so they're going to go and bathe something in the public bath, no matter what it was. They've got dirt and feces and grime from the street, which the streets are utterly filthy in Rome. And you'd have a thick layer, you know, several inches of muck in the streets in Rome. If you ever walked in Pompeii, you're literally, the streets are like trenches. That's what you would walk in, and that would be full. That wouldn't be clean like they are in Pompeii now. That'd be full of muck. So you wash all that stuff off in the bath. If you are interested in the services of a prostitute, for example, if she's a poor prostitute, she doesn't have, or he does not have a local establishment. They're transient just like everybody else. So the best place to do business is potentially in the public baths. Cockroaches breed in the baths as well as humans. You've got that going on as well. They were just utterly nasty. They were just disgusting. And so I doubt they really bade anybody clean, to the point where I quote Marcus Aurelius in the book, just saying, what is bathing? It's filthy. It's disgusting. You know, the water is oily and gross. I can't remember the quotation, but he kind of acknowledged, and he had some of the nicest baths, right? He had his own private baths. And well, even I mean, recognized
the first step is to have your own private bath to avoid the, you know, the prostitutes and the, anyway, the, all the, everyone else.
Yeah. And of course, but, I left off that thing that many people do in the pool and in the bath and in the lake, right? People pee in it too. So there's all sorts of urine in the bath water too.
Yeah. So that's nice. Rome is filthy. The supplies of food are uncertain. There's a large transient population, which I would imagine also floats around the city and maybe around regions.
That's right. And it's seasonal. It's seasonal as well. They come in and out based on like the labor that's available, right? During the agricultural, the harvest time, they're going to go out and then they're going to come back in during the time that people sell their wares and need little bits of help here and there. So, yeah.
You can't see gladiatorial combats down on the farm.
That's right.
That's just the way it is. You got to go to the big city for the fun. Mm-hmm. So, and perhaps not surprisingly then, it might be surprising to some people, Roman skeletons show a sort of continual malnourishment. You observe that they're smaller than early medieval Italian skeletons, yep. Which honestly kind of surprised me a little bit.
Yeah.
But
they're getting a reasonably good diet. It's just that their diet is so uncertain. So, yeah, Roman skeletons show a height difference of about 10 centimeters, which is pretty substantial compared their descendants later on in the medieval period and then compared to their ancestors in kind of the archaic, pre-archaic period. So Romans deal with chronic malnourishment largely from quantity of food. So they're getting a reasonably good diet when they're getting food. It's just that there is a lack of food security in the ancient world. There's kind of a routine, regular cycle of food shortages and famines. And again, when so much of the urban population is relying on distributions of food from a few bread baskets, when one of those has a problem, there's a shortage. But even the rural inhabitants, right, they're dealing with the vagaries of the Mediterranean climate too. And if you spent any time in the Mediterranean, you know that spring is a really variable time. There could be a frost that suddenly comes in February, right after things have budded, and it just kills the buds. There could be a heat wave that comes in March that will burn the crops basically and stunt the growth of crops. So these kinds of things could happen in rural settings as well. So even those peasant farmers that are not involved in the grain market or the state distribution of grain, they're just growing for themselves. They too are in a really precipitous situation.
Yeah. And once again, they have no wide-ranging network of supply network to back up any deficiencies they might have in their local harvest.
No.
I mean, we got to wait for the railroad for that, really. Steamships and a railroad to fix that. But at the same time, it's interesting to see that sort of that change in skeletal structure that you see happen like overnight in Britain between, say, the American Revolution and the Boer War when they're measuring heights of soldiers. You know, people being in industrial urban conditions and the resulting often malnourishment made people shorter in a generation. It does that. I should probably link to like papers on how fast the Japanese grew. People never realize how what food can do, as a friend of mine used to say, and just a generation to increase height, strength, and all the rest of it.
Well, and there's a connection between good nourishment, right? Getting the right amounts of macronutrients and micronutrients and being able to fight off disease. So that's what we're coming to. Yeah. Malnourishment with the Romans, and then the malnourishment is exposing them to disease.
So malnourishment exposes you, a sort of long-term lingering malnourishment exposes you to diseases. Yeah. And the final sort of, I think, piece of the pie is, what is the climate doing in the time of Marcus Aurelius, in the Mediterranean climate? We've had, I think, Philip Jenkins on talking about climate change and religious upheavals in history. Is there a lot of volcanic activity at the time around the world? I mean, can we trace that? Is volcanic activity at the time leading to some sort of climate changes and perturbations in the Mediterranean basin?
Yeah, this is a challenging topic, and I think the jury is still out. So I published an article back in 2016, which was looking at some Greenland ice cores, which do look like, which do give a signal. So the sulfates that a volcanic eruption spits out into the atmosphere, especially, well, just about anywhere, but especially in the northern hemisphere, will eventually make their way and fall in the snow to Greenland, to other areas where there's kind of permanent ice. They'll pack up, and then you can drill a core, and then you can get a sense as to what's going on in the atmosphere. And there is a signal for increased sulfates around kind of 150-ish, 160-ish AD. The problem is it's unclear what volcano or volcanoes were erupting, and it's difficult to say how widespread the effect of those eruptions or whatever caused the sulfates would be. So there might have been some volcanic activity. But what we do see, in addition to the sulfate signal, which suggests volcanic activity, is that there definitely were some climate disruptions in some parts of the Roman world and out beyond the Roman world in ways that affected the Roman world. So there are what appear to be drops in temperature and drops in precipitation around 150-ish AD in numerous parts of the world. So there is a signal that suggests volcanoes, and there is a signal that suggests changes in the climate, at least on the short term.
Okay, to the plague. Let me ask you the first most essential question that every listener is wondering and that I know is completely unfair to ask. So here it is. What was it?
That is unfair to ask because my answer is I don't know. After writing an entire book on the Antonine Plague, this book Pax Romana I just finished, I still do not feel comfortable saying what the disease was. I can talk a little bit about the description of it and give you a sense of what it could be, or at least maybe the family that it could be in. But even then, my colleagues will have an apoplexy if I name a disease.
Right. So we don't know. I mean, the assumption that people may think, oh, plague, so it must be bubonic plague. But yeah, it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, it's almost certainly not bubonic plague. The most prominent candidate has historically been smallpox, because the disease descriptions in the physician Galen's notes, he treated the disease, and he's a very famous doctor, and we have a lot of his writings from the middle to late second century AD. He describes the thing that looks like smallpox is he describes a pustular rash. He talks about ulcers in the throat, and he talks about a pustular rash, and he mentions a Greek word that kind of would imply scarring. There are some people that know a lot more about Greek than I do that dispute whether it means scarring or not. Some say it does, some say it doesn't. But that sounds like smallpox. That sounds like the pock marks and then the scarring, the telltale scars that are left after smallpox. The problem with that diagnosis is that we have genetic evidence now which confirms that modern smallpox did not reach antiquity. It goes back about 500 years, and that's about as far as it goes back. Now, that's not to say it wasn't a pox-like virus. So there are many pox viruses, chickenpox, cowpox, monkeypox, right? There are ancestors of smallpox that have cropped up at various times that are slightly different. They might be more or less deadly. They might affect this animal and not this and not that animal. They might affect humans and not affect this other thing. So there's still, to me, some evidence based on the description that we could be dealing with a pox-like virus, that sort of family of viruses. But we can't say for sure what it is because we don't have the genetic evidence. The closest thing we have are some skeletons from about 300 or 400 years later after the Antonine Plague, which do show evidence of an ancient pox virus of some kind, one that could infect both animals and humans, and which probably wasn't as virulent as modern smallpox. So modern smallpox kills about a third of its victims in a pre-industrial, pre-vaccination context, whereas this ancient virus that we see in these kind of Viking-era skeletons would have probably killed less. Again, it's tough to know because the genetic markers are not firm, but they do suggest a kind of pox virus.
So fortunately for you, no one discovered a body that they could do some really clever genetic archaeology on. while the book was going to press. Now it's out.
Yeah.
So that's okay.
Yeah.
But I it's one of those things reading this, I'm absolutely certain that someone's going to find a graveyard somewhere in the Mediterranean and be able to do some really clever research to figure out what I mean, the amount of work that's been done the last 5 years on victims of bubonic the Black Death in medieval England, it's really extraordinary.
Right.
What people are finding out.
And you know, Michael McCormick, right, who's been at the forefront of this and has been doing some great work on this with Justinianic plague. But interestingly enough, there has been some pushback on some of his views on the Justinianic plague. And this has all come after we've had the genetic confirmation of what the virus is. So if this happens with the Antonine plague, it will basically make the story more interesting. And the reason for that is because disease has a two-way relationship with human societies. So even if we found out what the Antonine plague was, and we were able to say, okay, well, this disease would normally kill this many people, and it has these markers and these symptoms, the disease occurs in a unique historical context. And that matters. That determines the spread of the disease. It determines how many people die. It determines who dies. Like, there are these, this bigger social and economic puzzle that would still need to be put together. And in some ways, we can put that puzzle together without having some key pieces, like even knowing what the disease was. So I was able to write this book without knowing what the disease was because we have the other parts of the puzzle. Like, we have these, this climate evidence now that we didn't have. We have more information about Roman skeletons. We have more information about the sanitation in the cities, about the Roman economy. Like, we've learned so much about the Roman economy in just the last kind of 20, 30 years. So when we do find genetic evidence for this disease, it'll be great in some ways for me. I'll get a chance to write a revised version of this book. And we'll get to see, though, we'll kind of have the cause. We have the effects, but we'll kind of know more about the cause.
You describe the disease as following human highways.
Yeah.
So what were these human highways and where do they originate from?
So
as best as we can tell.
Yeah. This is a great point. So I think there are really two. First of all, the disease infects humans, at least. We don't know if it infected animals as well. So there could, in theory, be animal highways. But if it's a pox virus of some kind, these usually are restricted to particular groups of animals. So like smallpox, for example, does not have an animal vector. Transmits via humans. So let's assume for a second that we're just looking at human movement. There are two big sources in the Roman world that we need to look at. One is trade. At this period of time, so there's some truth to the received version of the Pax Romana, which is Rome's trade networks had never been more expansive. Rome is trading down the eastern coast of Africa. It is trading all the way up north through the Amber Road up into the northern parts of Europe. It is trading along the Silk Roads all the way over to the Han Empire in China. And similarly, via the Indian Ocean, it is trading with India and it is trading with societies in Vietnam and even parts of China as well. So trade is potentially a big source. There are large ships that are moving through the Indian Ocean that would have been packed with dozens of people, sailors and rowers and whatnot, and traders and others that would be moving back and forth from the ports in Egypt and the Red Sea down and into the Indian Ocean and then along the western coast of India. So you've got that human highway, groups of traders, caravans, moving disease with them from the eastern part, from the northern part, from Africa into the Roman Empire and out. Then you also have the military. So the military had been stagnant for a period of time under the emperors Hadrian and Antoninus Pius. And that represents about a 40-year period in which the military were largely garrisoned in places and sort of policing trade, involved in taxing. They weren't really fighting active, large-scale wars. But as that period advanced, Roman soldiers are gradually following trade. So like there are Roman soldiers stationed in the Red Sea, for example, on the Pharasan Islands, just off the coast of southern Arabia, for example, well outside Roman borders. There are Roman soldiers up in the tippy top north of Britain. There are Roman soldiers quite extended. And then under Marcus Aurelius, all of those soldiers that are spread all across the Roman world and beyond coalesce to fight two major wars. One is against the Parthian Empire. So you get tens of thousands of soldiers suddenly surging into Parthia, which, by the way, seems to have been experiencing a disease outbreak. And then after the Parthian War, they all distribute back. So they gather in clusters, right? Almost like mobile cities in Parthia. And they besiege Parthian cities that sources tell us were dealing with disease at the time. And then they go back to their bases in Europe and Syria and Alexandria and other places. And then they fight a second war in Germania along the borders of the Danube. And similarly, they come from all different parts of the empire and they, you know, coalesce right there on the borders of the Danube. So you've got these pushes out into places where Romans are going to encounter disease that they've never encountered before, and then this sucking in back into the Roman Empire, back and forth. And that has to be a major conduit by which the Antonine Plague would have spread as it begun its terrorizing of the Roman Empire.
So what did the first wave of the pandemic do to Rome and to the Roman cities? Given the population distribution, as you point out, a couple places, there are going to be parts of the Roman Empire that never experienced it.
That's right.
In a way, which says something about lethality, perhaps, or how human contact went, but it's very unlike the Black Death, where there are very, very few places that were not affected.
That's right.
In medieval Europe. But the cities are definitely hardest hit.
That's right. The Black Death has the benefit of the animal vector, right? So because of the rats, the fleas, et cetera, I mean, I think many, you know, you could read Michael McCormick, you could read the book Justinian's Flea, right? We kind of explain how bubonic plague spreads. It can get into rural parts of the ancient and medieval worlds relatively easily because of the animals. With the Antonine Plague, we don't know that that's a vector. And we don't see a lot of evidence of disruption in rural parts of the Roman Empire. But what we do see, you're right, is cities. So the most urbanized regions of the Roman Empire largely seem to be the ones where we see the most trouble. So Asia Minor and Syria, Italy and Rome, for example, these are some of the hardest hit places, and Egypt. Rome experiences its first wave probably in the fall or maybe early spring, but I'm going to guess the fall of 166, because it's in the fall when Lucius Verus, Marcus Aurelius's co-emperor, celebrates his triumph over the Parthian Empire. And he brings in thousands of soldiers that have just been besieging these plague-infested cities. He marches them all the way from Antioch over to Rome. They march through the city streets. Tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 Romans, who knows how many, would have gathered and crowded to celebrate the triumph. At a triumph, there would be, you know, cash giveaways. It was a huge thing that everybody wanted to go see. And of course, that would make it what we now call a super spreader event, right? So I'm guessing that not too long after that is when we see the first wave in Rome. We have a couple of descriptions of it. It sounds like it was utter chaos, that essentially bodies just start piling up. The emperors are just dazzled by the amount of bodies, such that they pass laws to restrict where people can bury corpses, to try to stop people from basically chucking corpses in bushes and tombs and the Tiber River and tucking them down sewers and all sorts of things like that. They provide mass funerals, both for the general population, because there were so many victims that died, but also for elites too. There were elites that died. And this was what was really scary. This is why I think this accounts of this plague survive in literary sources, because the elites could not run away from this thing very easily. It was anywhere in just about any city that they went to. So it hits Rome pretty bad in 166. The mint apparently shuts down, because we can look at coin hoard evidence and see, get a sense for numbers of coins that are produced each year. And in the year 166 and 167, the coin production in Rome just takes a nosedive, which suggests to me that the city really kind of shut down and just could not operate well for perhaps months during this first wave of this pandemic.
You have a nice turn of phrase, which I intend to steal. And you refer to what then happened as the age of angst.
Yeah.
An age marinated in pestilence and panic, a pestilential world, an everlasting pestilence. So what you're saying is it hung around for a while. I mean, it becomes endemic. And this then, when things are endemic, that changes the psychology of people radically is what you're suggesting. I'm not suggesting, you're stating with evidence.
Yeah, that's right. So the disease was trouble for a few reasons. One is what I've just talked about, which is the virulence of it. I mean, it was deadly and it spread into cities. But as you rightly mentioned, it was long lasting. The name that Galen gave this thing was the everlasting pestilence, or the great pestilence, because it never stopped. It lasted at least a decade. It may have gone as long as 25 years. There's sort of reason to question that. I mean, I tend to cut this thing off probably around the 170s, 8165 to 8175. But you could make a reasonable argument that it lasts a lot longer. And yeah, it's essentially that it hits in waves. Because the Roman Empire is in about the worst spot you can be. It's well connected enough that the disease will spread. So it doesn't just stick to a city and then flare up and then die out. That would happen in a disconnected world. It would just kind of, and then it would go away. In a hyper-connected world like our world, we get the thing spreads rapidly and quickly, but we get the side benefit from, you know, the Industrial Revolution onward of getting immunity. Because the thing spreads so quickly and rapidly, we then can sustain pretty impressive population immunity. And that's even before treatments and vaccines and so on and so forth. So we have that benefit. Rome is in the middle. Rome is well connected enough that it will spread, but not well connected enough that immunity can kind of endure. And so you just get wave after wave after wave, and the disease will crop up in Rome, and then it will go away, and then it will gradually, you know, the next year it'll crop up in Aquileia in Italy, and then it will go away, and then it will crop up in Lugdunum in Lyon, and then eventually it'll make its way back to Rome. And it, so because the population could not sustain a degree of immunity. So it's a really severe disease. It's a long lasting disease. And nobody had seen anything like this. Nobody had encountered a disease that was this widespread and that would kind of keep coming back in this way in such a widespread network of cities. It was just distressing.
And I suppose as you bring new soldiers from one province to another, and as transients circle around within a region, you've continually providing fresh hosts for the virus.
Yeah, that's where the dry tinder really comes in and sets this thing ablaze, because now you have climate issues as well, right? So as people are trying to find food, they're going from city to city. They're looking for handouts, or they've moved from the country because their farm has failed because of poor temperature, you know, poor rainfall that year. And so they flood into the cities. We see the same thing with smallpox pandemics in Britain, for example, right? In the kind of 1600s, 1700s.
Same thing during the American Revolution.
Exactly. I mean, right. Same thing in Mexico as well, in kind of the same period. It's basically Rome has entered this era where it's not quite industrialized, but it's well connected enough to spread disease like this and to keep recycling the population so that cities will become immunologically naive after about 15, 20, 30 years, and the cycle will repeat itself.
What briefly were some of the cures and hopes for cures? I mean, Galen's involved, so obviously bleeding or vomiting or defecating. But other than that, I mean, there must be considerable evidence of charms and other ways of trying to avert fate.
Yeah. So you've got first of all, you've got like the practical interventions that a physician like Galen would try. Galen and other sources mention a few things. You're right to mention like expunging oneself, right? So bloodletting, evacuating one's bowels, vomiting, those sorts of things. That's one way to do it. And then you want to take things in that are good in terms of good airs. So the scents of laurel leaves, for example, incense, those sorts of things. Urine. There's this real fixation with urine, that urine is somehow, if you can get somebody to pee on the sores, that will help. So who knows? Maybe they thought the bat. Maybe this is a reason why they thought the bats.
I think okay, I prefer honey.
So you've got urine. So those are kind of the. Oh, and then the other thing is something called theriac, which was kind of a designer drug of the upper class. They wanted this. It was like a mix of exotic spices and other kinds of exotic ingredients, with a nice healthy dose of morphine as well, of opiates. So that was something that people liked to have when they had plague. Supposedly that could be a potential cure. Obviously, none of these things would have actually cured the plague. There just might have been a correlation with the disease dissipating after a couple of weeks and these cures. So those are like the more practical cures. There's some weird stuff, though, during the Antonine Plague, too, because of the newness of it, because it was such a novel event. There was a real search for religious causes and religious solutions, because the Romans do not think about medicine and disease in the same way that we do. We tend to look for scientific solutions. We try to find practical remedies. And the Romans are looking for impiety. If there's a disease, it means that a god somewhere is angry. And if there's a disease across the entire Roman Empire, probably means there are multiple gods angry. And they're angry with a lot of people, perhaps. And so you have whole cities. We have inscriptions from places like Ephesus, for example, and other cities in Asia Minor, where the plague remedies are like the whole city has to have a wall washed, and statues of Artemis or Apollo need to be set up at all of the gates of the city, pointing arrows outwards. And we all need to say magic words, and we need to, you know, there's even a kind of charlatan that shows up, and I'm sure there were many of these, but we know of one at least, who became a kind of celebrity during the, well, he was a celebrity before the Antonine Plague, but the Antonine Plague just kind of shot him up into stardom because he had some magic words that he claims that the god Asclepius gave him. He's a real weirdo. He's got a pet snake that he thinks is the reincarnation of the god Asclepius, and the pet snake will whisper in his ear and tell him the cure. And so the cure for the plague was you had to inscribe some magic words on your doorposts, or you had to wear them around your neck in a necklace, or put them on a bracelet, that sort of thing. And we even found one of these amulets all the way over in Great Britain. And this guy was operating way over in Asia Minor. So his cures kind of spread across the entire Roman Empire, where people were just kind of saying magic words, that sort of thing.
Somehow, I mean, this is goes all the way back to book one of the Iliad, right?
Yes, that's right.
You have to get right with the gods. Mm-hmm. Something bad has happened, then get right with a god who did that to you. Yep. This is the way the world works. This is just such a part of their worldview that we don't take seriously. But man, they sure as hell took it seriously. So we should take it seriously.
They did take it seriously. And the part that's the same, right? So there's a lot that's different. So
the aromatherapy and the essential oils are kind of the same.
That's
just
true.
Put that up.
That's true. Yeah.
The opiates.
Yes, that's right. But another thing that was the same was the search for scapegoats. So who is to blame? And again, for the Romans, this was a religious question. So I talk about this in the book, but there is an interesting connection. We don't have an explicit connection, but there's a kind of correlation between the Antonine Plague, its spread, its tenacity, the fear surrounding the Antonine Plague, the kind of social contagion that this thing was, as much as a viral or bacterial contagion, and then with persecution of unfavorable religious groups. In particular, Christians. So around the mid-second century AD, you have about 40,000 Christians, and Christians are largely in the places where the Antonine Plague would have been, in the cities. Christianity was still at this point an urban phenomenon. And so you have these people, they don't worship the Roman gods, they don't worship the emperor, they meet in private. They do weird things according to the Romans. Like, what are they doing when they're meeting in private and they're calling each other brother and sister and kissing each other, giving each other a holy kiss? They're eating the body and blood of Jesus. This sounds very creepy. It sounds like cannibalism. And so there's a group that's kind of right there that's ready to be blamed. And again, we don't have explicit evidence blaming them for the Antonine Plague, but we do have evidence from just after the Antonine Plague from the African Christian Tertullian, who does say that Christians were blamed for diseases, he's just writing it about 10, 15 years after the Antonine Plague. So you have to wonder if Christians too, and the persecution of Christians may have been associated with the Antonine Plague, because that ramps up right after the Antonine Plague. You get 50 Christians murdered in Lugdunum, France, right at the very end of the Antonine Plague, 177 AD. Men, women, and children, their bodies are burned, desecrated. I mean, there seems to be a connection there.
Well, if this hasn't been enough of a historical nerd fest for you, here we go. This is the part that you've been waiting for. For the rest of you, buckle up. We're going to talk about evidence. You have how the plague exhausted the empire. And man, it was like, it took me 30 years back to attending a McCormick undergraduate seminar. Only then you had to show slides and handouts of various types of evidence. You deal with diplomas to Roman soldiers. We'll explain what those are. Lead emissions and ice cores, pottery in London, coin quality, land prices in Egypt, real rents in Egypt. And I know I'm leaving some things out, but that'll do us. And with the limited time we have, diplomas to Roman soldiers, what are they when they get their baccalaureate? I mean, what is this?
Right. So we talked about the Roman army near the beginning of the podcast and how for non-citizen soldiers, they would get at the end of their service a grant of land and they'd often get citizenship. Now, how do you prove that you have citizenship? Well, what you do is at the end of your 25 years of service, you get a plaque. And it could be a wax tablet. It could be a bronze tablet, usually is what it is. And inscribed in that bronze tablet would be, you know, thus and Publius Aurelius is now a Roman citizen. He has the right to marry. He has the right this, that. And so they would get these diplomas that would specify all the rights that they had earned for their 25 years of service. What's fascinating is these totally dry up around the time that the Antonine Plague hits. They just disappear. We can find them because they're in bronze. And we're finding them regularly, like several each year, over and over and over again, all the way up to 165. And then, boom, they disappear, which suggests that either soldiers were not living and were not therefore retiring, so they were just dying. It could also suggest that they were being held longer into service because of the problems with the Marcomannic War, and there were recruitment troubles and so on and so forth. But then eventually we would expect to see the discharge papers. There is also a possible theory that it doesn't have anything to do with plague, that maybe the diplomas were no longer relevant around 165 because there was a change in the rights that were granted to soldiers about 25 years earlier. So when they signed up, their rights and privileges were curtailed, and so they didn't really need a diploma from 165 onward. So there, and all of those things could be operating too. Those are not mutually exclusive things. So it does look like from the military diplomas and from some other evidence surrounding the military that soldiers were dying in higher numbers and that there were recruitment troubles, that soldiers were being held on for longer and longer services. And again, that can be plague-related. And in addition to plague, it can be war related as well because of these wars that break out.
The lead emissions and ice cores, what's that about?
Yeah. So this is pretty fascinating. Some people that are much brighter than me and know a lot more about this subject than I did took some ice cores very recently from Greenland. And again, as I mentioned earlier, These will show the atmospheric sulfate. So they'll tell us volcanic activity, but they will also show us lead emissions, lead pollution in the atmosphere. And what produces lead pollution at this time is the smelting of metals, in particular, the mining and minting of silver. So taking extracting silver from ores, because lead is a byproduct of that process, and then minting silver coins can also emit some lead. What's fascinating is the amount of lead pollution just plummets around 165, again, around the time that the Antonine Plague kicks off. What this suggests is that the mines that were producing the silver that had been very reliable up till this point suddenly stopped producing. Now, it could be a coincidence and that all of these various mines all dry up at the same time. The Romans are mining in Spain. They're mining in the province of Dacia, which is now modern Romania. They're mining other places. And it could just be that they all dry up at the same time. But the more likely explanation is that a combination of warfare in some of these places, but also the spread of the disease is killing mine workers. I mean, you have got lots of workers, transient, unhealthy workers, shoved down in an indoor space for long periods of time. This is not good for in terms of spreading a disease. And it does look like this drop in lead emissions is permanent. The Roman Empire does not recover from whatever happens during the time of the Antonine Plague. Again, plagues are certainly a factor. So too are wars. So too are our other aspects as well. So the economic effect of that is huge. Suddenly the coins cannot be minted at full quality silver. So you have to debase the currency, causes economic problems like price inflation, for example. The soldiers are suddenly agitating for more money because their money's not going as far. But there's no money to give them because you have to mint silver to give them money. So increasingly, you're minting even more debased coins to give out to the soldiers because you got to keep them happy or they're going to turn and rebel against you. And that's basically what happens in the decades following the Antonine Plague. These soldiers essentially start running the empire and start appointing various emperors in different regions of the empire, in large part because of promises of pay, because the economy basically tanks.
So this is what you mean by, you say that even after the pandemic died out, the ghost of the Antonine Plague haunted many. Now, that's immediately, you're speaking of Commodus, Marcus mm-hmm. Aurelius' son, successor, but it's a bigger point. It's a more meta point as well.
Yeah.
The ghost is at the feast of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. It's affecting the army revolts. It's inflationary to the economy. It's doing lots of other different things.
Yes.
Than just affecting the life. Well, I mean, it's already killed a lot of people too, but there's no, you know, what's always fascinating about the Black Death is the massive economic recovery
yeah.
within 20 years in parts of Italy. I mean, Italy gets in some ways richer
yeah.
than it had been before, but that's not happening in Rome.
No, you're exactly right. And it is kind of like a ghost because the Antonine Plague itself, and this is an argument in the book, I don't think the Antonine Plague is kind of this big exogenous shock. It's not, and it's not acting alone. Right. So it's affecting and it's kind of accelerating these processes. We talked at the beginning of the podcast about how fragile actually the Roman Empire was and how unhealthy it was. It was in some ways just teetering. And what the Antonine Plague does is it sort of triggers a set of catastrophes that had been building.
This is the concept of catastrophe flip.
The catastrophe flip, yeah, which I borrow from the medieval historian Chris Wickham. I mean, and he may have borrowed it from somebody else, but I got it from him. It's this great explanation for historical change in instances like this. Usually, things happen gradually and then suddenly, right? There's a gradual part first, and that's what the catastrophe flip describes. There is a insidious problem with food supply, climate, military, economy, slave labor, agriculture, all these things are there under the surface in the first 150 years of the Pax Romana. And the Antonine Plague acts as an accelerant. It just, boom, it's like a spark that catches that on fire. And then, boom, you get this ghost that lingers long after. And so the Antonine Plague is forgotten. It goes away. It's no longer thought of. It's no longer written about. You get really no serious discussion of pandemic or plague in the sources until the mid third century. So a good 70 years later. But the effects, the lingering ghost of the Antonine Plague is there in all of these areas, economy, religion, the politics of the empire, civil wars, the food supply. I mean, it's there. It's a lingering presence, a ghost that doesn't quite have form anymore, but is continuing its reach in the history of Rome. And yeah, there is really no substantial recovery, in my view. And again, historians will debate this. We don't really know, but from the economic proxies that I have looked at, I do not see a substantial recovery to pre-plague levels at any point in the rest of the history of the Roman Empire.
And when plague happens again, 75 years later, conditions, the tinders is higher and deeper and yes. wider.
Yeah, it's like a bunch of lighter fluid has been thrown on the fire as well. Because under Marcus Aurelius, you have you still have some vestiges of stability. You have had a period of emperors that have been stable. The Annona, the grain supply system, the state grain supply system has been working. You have had climate conditions that have been favorable. People have been paying their taxes. Like, you have a legacy that you can, that can kind of weather the pandemic. And yes, it's permanently damaged, but the context is nowhere near as troubled as what we see in the third century. In the mid third century, when the Cyprianic plague happens, Rome has been in the midst of civil wars for decades. The silver coinage the so-called silver coinage has about 2% silver in it. It is a joke of a currency. Prices are all over the place. Grain prices are fluctuating like crazy. There is no loyalty in the military whatsoever. They're just chasing after multiple regional emperors at any given time. The entirety of Gaul has broken away. Britain has broken away. Palmyra, so Syria and the East, has broken away. It is a period of disunity and chaos. And then the Cyprian plague hits in the middle of that. So Rome has really lost any sense of stability at that point. And I don't know whether the Cyprianic plague too was really necessarily in and of itself a major disease, but because it hits at this terrible moment, it must have been truly devastating.
I want to finish by reading from Cyprian, the Christian bishop in Carthage. And it is, we were talking before about the differences between our quote unquote pandemic.
Yeah.
And the big one and the yes. big ones.
Yes.
And it's reading a Cyprian. Well, let me just read it first and we can talk about it. He says, "The world has now grown old. In the winter, the supply of rain is not so plentiful for the nourishment of seeds. There's not the accustomed heat in the summer for ripening the harvest. Neither are the cornfields so joyous in the spring, nor are the autumn seasons so fecund. To a less extent are slabs of marble dug out of the disemboweled and weary mountains. To a less extent do the mines already exhausted produce quantities of silver and gold, and the impoverished veins are lessened day by day. The farmer is vanishing and disappearing in the fields, the sailor on the sea, the soldier in the camp, innocence in the market, justice in the courts, harmony among friendships, skill among the arts, discipline in morals. Wars continue with greater frequency. Barrenness and famine accumulate anxiety. Health is broken by raging diseases. The human race is laid waste by ravages of pestilence." In an era where we hear about like fatigue, like Americans are fatigued with a war in Ukraine, which they're not fighting, or, you know, we talk about like the terrible threats that face us. I mean, that's declinism.
Yeah.
I mean, that is high grade double, triple X, 150 proof declinism. The living world, that gives forth marble and silver, even that's drying up. The world is dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's, the living organism of Gaia is,
yes.
shriveling, you know. That's the sort of the world that was created, you're yeah. saying, by this great, the plague of Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you read that passage. That passage, you can read it in your head when you read the book. But for those of you that buy Pax Romana, when you get to that quote from Cyprian at the beginning of part three, read it out loud to yourself so you can hear what he says, because I think it's meant to be read out loud. You can hear in it.
It's poetry. I want to go find the original, because I bet he could set it to verse or something like that.
Yes. It's beautiful. It's a kind of beautiful tragedy of Cyprian explaining to a population that is looking for answers as to why so much has gone wrong. And yes, you're right. It pales in comparison. What we've experienced pales in comparison to what Cyprian was describing. I mean, literally everything was falling apart in his age. And yeah, for him, the Antonine Plague is a distant memory. In fact, he might not even know much about what the Antonine Plague was, but he's living in a world that was in part shaped by what happened under Marcus Aurelius, the kind of economic conditions, the problems with the coinage, the environmental issues that now were persisting longer and longer, the dried up mines, the labor shortages, the shrinkage of the tax base, the disruptions of grain supply, the migrations and movements and wars. I mean, you heard Cyprian say it. I don't need to repeat it all. This was for him a dying world. And for him, it was a sign, right? It was evidence that God's judgment was coming. Right. And so for the Christians, it's funny. They did a very good job of not only like surviving the Antonine Plague and the Cyprianic Plague, they did a very good job of explaining it. So for the kind of traditional Roman religious devotees, there was no answer because they sacrificed, they sought out, they built the statues, they washed the walls, they cleaned the temples, they did everything that they were supposed to do. And things continued to get worse and worse and worse. Whereas for the Christians, they could say, look, we're preaching that the world is supposed to grow old. This is what God has told us, that there is going to be a judgment and that actually God will judge the world. And that's coming. And this is a warning. So you better convert to Christianity so that you can escape this judgment and the judgment that's coming. Is a very powerful evangelical tool for people like Cyprian. And so they were able to take these arguments that the non-Christians were throwing at them, which was, hey, you're responsible for all of this. And Cyprian was able to turn that on its head and say, actually, you're responsible for it. And we have an explanation for it too, that fits a lot better than what you're saying. And so you need to convert to our way of thinking. And eventually, Cyprian won the argument. The Roman Empire would become Christian, although they would not arrest the decline of the Roman Empire. It would continue and eventually fall apart.
My guest today is Colin Elliott. He is the author of, most recently, Pax Romana, The Plague That Shook the Roman World. And he also hosts a podcast. Who doesn't have their own podcast these days? His is excellent. It's Pax Romana, the Pax Romana podcast, only 14 minutes long, unlike this conversation. And so it's like a little classical sort of, you know, amuse-bouche.
That's
to
right.
Set you up for, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So Pax Romana podcast is essentially like a 15-minute commute length podcast. We share stories from...
You got a short commute, buddy.
Yeah, the Roman... I do. I'm very privileged to live in Bloomington, Indiana, where there is really no substantial traffic. And so anyway, it's a nice short podcast that tells stories from the Roman Empire, villains, heroes, economy, politics, religion. It's a lot of fun. It's stuff that I talk about in my classroom, and we've got it on the Pax Romana podcast.
Well, Colin Elliott, thank you for being part of Historically Thinking.
And thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
And thanks so much to you as well for being a part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, then share it with a friend or many friends. Vivian Lundy is our assistant producer. John Ruddat is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back next week with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.